lecture, problems with the standard model. Okay, obviously I can't teach you all of the Beyond the Standard Model class in this last lecture, but you'll have another course on that. So I've had to pick and choose a couple different topics. So it's going to be incomplete because there's lots of problems with the standard model, but we'll just focus on a couple of them. And the first one I'm going to talk about is neutrino masses. So neutrinos are, of course, massless in the standard model just by assumption. For a long time, people thought that they were massless because their masses are very small. So we know now that they do have masses, but their masses are just very, very tiny. So, so neutrinos do have a small but non-zero mass. And we're not actually sure exactly what they are, but we know they're less than around 1 electron volts. In contrast, the next heaviest particle, the electron, which is the lightest particle in the standard model, has a mass of 511 kiloelectron volts. So it's much, much heavier than the neutrinos, as well as all of the other fermions in the standard model are much, much heavier. So there's a question, you know, why are neutrinos so much lighter than other fermions in the standard model? And how do they get a mass? So it's easy to include neutrino masses in exactly the same way as we did for the other leptons and quarks in the standard model. We would just write down a Yukawa term like this. So we have minus, we have some other Yukawa matrix, y nu, ij. And then we'd have to write down a right-handed neutrino field, nu I. Then we have the left-handed lepton field, llj, transpose, epsilon tensor, and then the Higgs, plus complex Hermitian conjugate. So this would be exactly the same structure that we wrote down for the other fields. The only thing we need to do is we need to introduce the right-handed neutrino field, which we didn't do before because it's not part of the standard model. So I can expand this in unitary gauge. You'll get yij nu, then you'll have a new right I and a new left j. And we'll have 1 plus h over v, and then I need a v over the square root of 2. So this quantity here, of course, is going to be the mass matrix for neutrinos. But we needed to introduce the right-handed neutrino field. And under the standard model gauge symmetries, they don't carry color. They don't carry SU2 left because they're right-handed, and they don't carry hypercharge. So they're singlets under everything. So nu right I has the quantum numbers of a singlet under color, a singlet under SU2 left, and it has zero hypercharge since it has zero electric charge. So it's a singlet under all gauge interactions. All right. Now you can go through the usual story. You can diagonalize the mass matrix using a biunitary transformation. So we want to define the following fields. So nu right I and j, sorry, that's not what I want to write. Nu I, left or right, so these are the fields I wrote down above, have to be rotated by a unitary matrix U, nu left right, ij acting on some primed fields, nu left right j. So this is what we did before. We used a biunitary transformation to diagonalize the mass matrix. So now the mass term is diagonal. So we have minus m nu I, and then nu prime I right, nu prime I left, plus Hermitian conjugate, and then times 1 plus h over v. So we've diagonalized the mass term. But now, just like for quarks, the charge-current interaction will no longer be diagonal for leptons. So the new charge-current interaction is no longer diagonal. So we'll just write it down. We had the charge-current interaction for just for leptons. It was minus g over the square root of 2. Then we had a new bar left I gamma mu e left I. But now we need to include this extra mixing. So now plus Hermitian conjugate. Now when we go to the other basis of fields, the primed basis, the mass eigenstates, we have minus, this should be a W plus slash, there we go. Now we go to the primed fields, we'll have G over the square root of 2, and then we'll have nu prime left I. Now we'll have a matrix U star nu left ij. We'll have a u e left jk, and then we'll have a w slash plus, and then an e prime left k plus Hermitian conjugate. So now there's no reason for these two matrices to give you the identity back, and they actually don't. So this whole matrix I can write as a unitary matrix, which is called u dagger, just by convention. And so I've defined a new matrix, a mixing matrix, for the leptons, which is u, and it's u e left dagger u nu left. So there we go. It's like the analog of the CKM matrix, but for leptons. And this is called the PMNS matrix.
So this is in contrast to when we rotate the massless neutrinos by UEL. So this
Yeah, that's exactly right. So for when we, if neutrinos are massless, it doesn't matter how we rotate the fields. You can choose anything because there is no mass term. So we're free to redefine the fields to anything you like. But now you're fixed. You have to rotate the neutrino fields to diagonalize the mass term, and this is the matrix that does it. And so now these two things don't cancel out because this one is a different matrix. Before we had used just U E left here, but now we have a different matrix. Okay, so PMNS, it stands for Pontecorvo, Maki, Nakagawa, and Sakata. So there we go. But actually, you might be nervous, because the principle of the standard model, remember, was we want to write down all possible interactions that are consistent with gauge symmetries and renormalizability. And that's actually not the case. We haven't exhausted all the possibilities involving the neutrino fields, because when you have a singlet field, there's nothing that forbids us from writing down a mass term. Remember, the mass terms for all the other fields are forbidden by gauge symmetry, but for a singlet field, it's not, obviously, because there is no gauge symmetry to forbid it. So we can write down a Majorana mass term for nu right I. And here it is. Since it's not forbidden by the gauge symmetry, so that is 1/2 Mij, and then we have the Majorana mass, which takes this form, nu right bar I nu right Cj plus nu right bar I C nu right J. So C denotes charge conjugation. And just so the notation is clear, when I say nu right C, for example, this is first you take the right-handed component, and then you charge conjugate it. So this would be like P right acting on the neutrino field, and then charge conjugated. OK. All right, so what I'll do is this actually is very interesting, because it's much different than what we get for other fermions. And let's see what happens. And let's forget about the fact that we have three generations for now. We're just going to consider this for one generation of neutrino. If you want to do it for three generations of neutrino, you just have more indices to worry about. But it works exactly the same way. So what we're going to write down is the mass term for one generation of right-handed and left-handed neutrino. So we have the Dirac mass, which is the Yukawa term that we wrote down. So I'll just call that little m. And then that's nu bar right, nu left, plus nu bar left, nu right. So m is the Dirac mass, which is just the Yukawa coupling times the VEV over the square root of 2. And then we also have the Majorana mass, which is 1/2 m. And then we have nu right bar, nu right c, plus nu right bar c, nu right. So there we go. We have a Majorana mass, and then we have a Dirac mass, which mixes the left and right-handed components. So let's write this in a nice way. So first, I want to note the following. I can write nu right bar, nu left, as equal to nu bar left C, nu right C. And also nu left, nu right, I can also write that as nu right bar C, nu left C. OK. So now, using these identities, I can write the neutrino mass terms in the following way. I can write it as a matrix equation. So I have nu bar C left, nu bar right as a two-component row vector. And then I have a matrix 0, M, M, capital M. And then I have nu left, nu right C, and then plus Hermitian conjugate. So you can check this just by expanding all of this out using these identities, and then you'll get exactly this back. All right. So now you can see the mass matrix is not diagonal anymore for neutrinos. I have a Dirac mass and a Majorana mass, and what I want to find are the mass eigenstates.
Sorry, one question.
Yeah?
What do you mean when you say charge conjugation of the right-handed neutrino? I mean, it has no charges because it's a singlet. And so what happens?
It's really just
the gamma 2, or?
It's really just acting on it with the charge conjugation operator. And it works exactly the same way as for a Dirac field. The way I think about it is in two-component spinners. So in general, if I write down a Dirac fermion, I could write it in terms of two two-component spinners as, let's say, I have this C as the upper two components. This would be the left-handed component. And for the bottom component, I would write it as another two-component spinner. Let's just call it eta dagger. And so this would just be like the right-handed component. So what I mean by psi right would just be 0 up here and then eta dagger, like this. Okay. And now what I mean by, so psi conjugate would also, the only thing psi conjugate does is it just flips these two things and then acts on both of them with a dagger. And so what you get is this is eta c dagger, like this. And so what I mean by psi right conjugate, which is psi right and then conjugated, this would be this. So here, conjugated, and then I just flip them and dagger them. So this is just eta and then 0, like this. This is what I mean. OK. And so you see, psi right conjugate is actually a left-handed guy, right? Because I act on it. P left, I get this. Act on it, P right, I get 0. OK. Yeah?
To clarify, what you said is that the psi RC, that it's ordered. You do R first, and then you do C operation.
Psi, yeah, it's what I wrote here. So first you...
You project.
First you project to take the right-handed component, and then charge conjugate it. Yeah. Yeah, I recognize that most people don't use this notation. Okay. Most people just think about it in terms of the two-component spinners, but...
I have a reference to
it. Yeah? Okay. But I like this because you can write everything in terms of Dirac spinners using the same language. All right, so what we want to do is figure out what are the mass eigenstates for in the neutrinos. So you can diagonalize this matrix, or I should say you should just compute the eigenvalues of this matrix. So compute the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, which are the mass eigenstates. So what you get is the neutrino mass term, once you've diagonalized it, and this is a good exercise, is you get a Majorana mass. So you get two states. One you can call, one is just called nu. And this is approximately, I forgot to mention one thing. So I forgot to mention one thing. I just want to mention that for the Dirac mass, it's really just set by the Yukawa coupling, y, right, times the VEF. So even if y is 1, the most that the Dirac mass could be is the VEF over square root of 2, which is around the mass of the top. So the most that the Dirac mass can be is around 100 GeV or so, but of course it could be anything. Now, for big M, the mass of the Majorana mass for new rights, there's no restriction on what it could be. There's no VEV, per se, that sets what this mass is. And so it's interesting to think, well, what if it's just much, much heavier than the weak scale? If it's much, much lighter than the weak scale, then neutrinos just look like Dirac, and it's the Dirac story I wrote before. But if it's much, much heavier than the electroweak scale, then it's very interesting. So what I'll do is I'll assume that big M is much, much greater than little m. Now we can compute the eigenvalues and the eigenstates. What you get is that one eigenstate, which you called nu, is approximately the same thing as nu left. And another eigenstate, which you call n, is approximately the same thing as nu right. And so the neutrino mass terms, once you've diagonalized, is just minus 1/2 the mass of the neutrino. And then nu bar c, and then minus 1/2 the mass of n, and then n bar c n. Yeah, n is a Majorana fermion, which is mostly nu right.
The nu and n are the mass eigenstates of the Bow matrix.
Yeah.
And you're saying it is approximately mu, right? If we are considering the case that our element is much greater.
Yeah.
It's approximately that one.
Yeah, so let me just use this notation just to make it clear. So let's say nu right, as I mentioned, would just be 0 eta dagger. And nu left would just be c 0. Now you can just take those components by themselves and form a Majorana a fermion. And I'm saying that n, a Majorana a fermion, would be like eta, eta dagger. And this, you can form another Majorana fermion, which is like C, C dagger. I don't know if that makes sense. So you can just take the left and right-handed components and form a four-component Majorana fermion out of those. And for the masses, the mass of the heavy state is just approximately the mass of the heavy mass that you put into the mass matrix. But for the mass of the light state, a very interesting thing happens. And you can compute this just by computing the eigenvalues of that matrix. What you find is that the neutrino mass for the light state is m squared, the Dirac mass squared, divided by the heavy scale, m. So this would be the light neutrino state that we see experimentally. And this would be a very, very heavy state that we haven't discovered, because it's just very, very heavy. So this idea is called the seesaw mechanism. And the idea is that the neutrinos are light because the right-handed components get a very large, or I should say have, a very large Majorana mass. So I just want to plug in some numbers. If I say y times v is around 1 GeV, and the heavy mass is around 10 to the 9 GeV, then I get the mass of the neutrino is around 1 electron volt. So I can take a totally normal value for the Dirac mass. This would be like the tau mass. But I just need a very, very heavy Majorana right-handed neutrino to give us a very, very light neutrino. So this would have a Yukawa coupling, which is around 10 to the minus 2, which is around the same as the tau Yukawa coupling. On the other hand, if you didn't include this mass, and you just wanted neutrinos to be Dirac, you would need a very, very tiny Yukawa coupling to give you a very small electron mass. So for Dirac neutrinos, the Yukawa coupling would have to be around 10 to the minus 12 or less. So this would be weird, right? If it's so small, why are the neutrino Yukawas so small compared to the other Yukawas? All right. Yeah?
What would this very massive N particle correspond to then?
It would be a very, very heavy neutrino. So it would just, yeah, it's just, I don't know what to say.
Isn't this within, like, the energy scales that are being measured?
10 to the 9? No. So the energy scales that are being measured are only 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 GeV. So this is way, way beyond that.
I think the question is why 10 to the minus 12 is weird, but 10 to the 9 is not weird.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I guess, so the theorist bias viewpoint is that all dimensionless numbers should be of order 1. Or not too far from order 1. So 10 to the minus 12 is weird. On the other hand, dimensionful numbers could be set by any kind of dynamics happening at different scales. And so we don't know what that dynamics is. And there's no reason to say that 10 to the 2 GeV is preferred compared to 10 to the 9, or 10 to the 9 is preferred compared to 10 to the 2. So we don't really know. which is which. There's no reason why to favor one versus the other. The other way to look at it is, you know, why are the neutrinos, why do they have very small Yukawas when everything else doesn't have, even the electron has a Yukawa which is only 10 to the minus 6 or so. So why are the neutrino Yukawas, you know, a million times smaller than the smallest other Yukawa?
It is pretty variable, so like fundamentally there is no
Yeah, there's no
rational to proportional to a small.
Yeah, that's right. So it's just a you could think of it as just a parameter, and so so it just is what it is. I'm not trying to say that this is preferred. The seesaw mechanism is preferred, but it's one way to explain why you get such a small number. Okay.
But suppose you don't have the Marana mass, then you will see the decay from X to neutrinos, given that the neutrinos, like right and left, yeah.
Yeah, in principle, you would have Higgs decaying into new left and new right, but because the Yukawa coupling would be 10 to the minus 12, the rate would be very, very small, so it's just impossible to see. Okay, so there's lots more I could tell you about neutrino physics. I could talk about neutrino oscillations, things like that. But we have to move on because I have to cover all of Beyond the Standard Model physics. And I'm running out of time. So the next interesting question is, what is the origin of flavor? So another way to say this is, why are there three generations? And another question, which kind of goes along with this, is why are the CKM and P, M, N, S matrices so different? So I haven't really talked about what the values of the CKM matrix elements are, but I'm just going to write them down for you. If I just take the magnitude of all of the entries, so the magnitude of all the entries of this 3x3 matrix, what you get are these numbers, 0.97, 0.23, 0.009. 0.23, 0.97, 0.04, 0.004, 0.04, 0.999. So you can tell that this matrix is fairly closely aligned with the identity matrix, right? The numbers along the identity are equal to 1. And the farther you go off the diagonal, the numbers get smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's closely aligned with the identity matrix 1. If it was exactly equal to 1, there would be no mixing in the quark sector. There would be no charge current interaction that violated flavor. And in contrast, let me write down the PM and S matrix. So I'll do the same thing for the PM and S matrix. It is 0.82, 0.23, 0.44, 0.54, 0.70, 0.45, 0.15, 0.62, 0.77. It really just looks like you just picked some random numbers out of a hat between 0 and 1. There is no sense in which it's closely aligned with the identity. So this kind of goes under the name of anarchy. So the question is, why is mixing in the quark sector small, but in the lepton sector you seem to have anarchic mixing?
What do you mean by absolute?
So in general, there are one or more complex phases in these matrices, and I'm just taking the magnitude of each element in this matrix. But in general, they can be complex, but I'm just taking the magnitude. So I don't really have any answers to that. But it's a very challenging question that I'm not sure there are any very good answers so far. The next issue has to do with the structure of the standard model, not the flavor, but the other part of the standard model. And you could ask, you know, why are there three gauge groups? And a bunch of follow-up questions. You know, why does SU2 left violate parity? Can quarks and leptons be unified in a single representation? Another question is, why do fermions have sort of seemingly ad hoc hypercharge assignments? Remember, we had to pick the particular values of the hypercharges to make the standard model consistent. But for a U1 symmetry, you can pick those hypercharges to be any number. Doesn't have to be an integer. Doesn't have to be rational. You can pick any number you like, but we had to pick these particular values in order for the standard model to describe nature. So why do we get those values? So all of these issues go under the general topic of what's called unification. And I'll just describe very briefly some ideas for unification. So the first, or maybe just one idea, is called the Patti-Salam model. This takes the gauge group of SU4 cross SU2 left cross SU2 right. So it has three gauge groups, like the standard model, which you might say, OK, that's not much of an improvement. But you would be wrong, because this has a lot of very nice features, which I'll describe. So first of all, it sort of restores parity. The fact that parity is broken by SU2 left is just a statement that perhaps the scale of symmetry breaking in SU2 left is much lighter than the scale of symmetry breaking in SU2 right. So the reason that we see this gauge group and not this one is just the fact that the gauge bosons just might be much heavier. So we don't see the terms that would restore parity. The other nice thing is that quarks and leptons are unified. So what you can write down is a left-handed spinner representation, which has the following quantum numbers under this gauge group. It's a fundamental under SU4, a fundamental under SU2, and a singlet under SU2 right. And what this is the following object. So it has four components in the SU4 direction, two components in the SU2 left direction. So I'm going to write it as a 4 by 2 matrix. So the first, I have U right red, D right, U left red, D left red, U left green, D left green, and then U left blue, D left blue. So three out of the four are just color. And the two is just the normal SU2, just U and D in the doublet component. But now the fourth color is the lepton. So we write down nu left, E left. So lepton number in this model is the fourth color. So there are four colors, and the fourth one is lepton number. And there's the same thing for the right-handed guys. So it's a 4 and then a singlet under left, and then a doublet under right, and it has exactly the same form, except I would just swap left and right. So now I've unified. Instead of having all these different representations for quarks and leptons, I just have two representations per generation. The other nice thing, yeah?
So the coupling to the SU2 left and SU2 right is different?
Yeah, it can be different in general, but it could be the same.
So in this case, if you want to restore the parity, then they have to be the same.
Yeah, if parity was exact, there would be a symmetry where you exchange left and right. That's right, and that's fine. But you get a difference because the Higgs sector could have different couplings. And so the breaking of this SU2 right can be different than the breaking of the SU2 left. So for example, the masses of the W right, which couple to right-handed charge currents, would be different and heavier compared to the normal W that we have.
But in that sense, you also sort of break the parity.
Yes, you're just breaking it in the Higgs sector spontaneously. So this, I should say, gets broken down to SU3 color cross SU2 left cross U1 Y. The other thing that's nice, it is explains hypercharge. The hypercharge U1 is a combination of SU4 and SU2 right generators. So what you get out are exactly the hypercharge assignments that you need that you have in the standard model. Okay. All right, so that was Patty Salam model. Now we'll talk about the Georgi Glashow SU5 model. SU5 is the smallest simple group that can contain the whole standard model. So I only have one gauge group with one gauge coupling. So it's broken SU5 to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 Y. And again, so it unifies all three gauge groups. So this goes into the name of grand unified theory. Or known as a gut. And now all of the standard model fermions fit into two representations. So there's an anti-fundamental of SU5, which in terms of Young tableau would just be this. And I'll just write it down in components, just so you get an idea. The first three of the five bar are D right conjugate. And then with the color indices alpha, so alpha is equal to RGB. So those are the first three components. And then the next two components are the left-handed lepton fields. So this would just be nu left, E left, for example. So this is the lepton doublet. So again, you're fitting quarks and leptons into the same representation under the symmetry. The other representation you need, of course, this is not all of the standard model fields, is a 10, which is, in terms of Young tableau, it's this. So it is a 5 by 5 anti-symmetric matrix. And you can fit in all of the other standard model fields in that matrix, although I won't write it down. So this is nice. The next one I'll do The last one I'll do is also due to Georgi. It's called SO10. So it's slightly different. It's SO, not SU. This one is kind of cool because you can fit all standard model fermions plus the right-handed neutrino in a single representation of SO10. So not only does it unify the three gauge groups, but you can fit all of the fermions plus the right-handed neutrino in the same representation. So it's a 16-dimensional representation. 16 because you have two quarks to fit in, which are U and D, times two chiralities, times three colors, plus two leptons, E and nu, times two chiralities, is equal to 16. So all of the components of that representation correspond to standard model fields. And then, of course, you need one for every generation. Doesn't explain the flavor problem. So this is nice. SO10 actually includes not only SU5, but also the Patti-Salam model, because you can break SO10 in two different ways. You can break it to SU5, which is then broken to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, standard model. Or you can break it to Patti-Salam, which is then broken to this. So you can think of both of these two models as, you should think of SO10 as perhaps a more complete version of either of these two models. So unification is a very cool idea. But before you get too enamored with it, there's a conservation law that you should keep in mind. And this is my own bias rant. I'll just preface by saying that. So we could think of all of these models as falling into a plane where I could plot this as sort of the fermion gauge sector. In going from simple to complicated. And obviously, we're doing good by having smaller and smaller gauge groups and smaller representations for the fermions. But there's a flip side, which is I need to make the Higgs sector more and more complicated to reproduce, to break all of these extra symmetries that I'm introducing. So I can also plot the Higgs sector in similar axes from complicated to simple, or vice versa. And so the standard model, I would say, is complicated in terms of fermions and the gauge sector, but it's very simple in terms of the Higgs sector. I only have one Higgs doublet, and it can give mass to everything, including neutrinos. So the standard model definitely lives here, because I can do everything with just one Higgs doublet. But if I go to the Patti-Salam model, well, I'm moving up, but I need additional Higgs representations to break the extra symmetries. So I would put the Patti-Salam model somewhere over here. And SU5, again, is even more complicated in terms of the Higgs sector. And then actually SO10 is hugely complicated in terms of its Higgs sector that you need to break all of these symmetries. So although you're gaining by going from here to here in terms of this part of the Lagrangian, it's actually getting more and more complicated in terms of the Higgs sector. So there's kind of seems to be a conservation of complexity. Even though you're trying to make the model simpler and simpler, the Higgs sector somewhat gets more and more complicated.
If you're right-handed, for example,
No, it's not. So if you want to include the right-handed neutrino, which you need to do for neutrino masses, you also need a singlet, which is the right-handed neutrino. That's a good question.
String theory doesn't
Yeah, right, that's right, that's a good point. So let me draw where string theory is. Is this the right way? Yes. Oh, okay, yeah. I guess it could be. Yeah, so I'm not sure. It lives somewhere along the top of the board, I guess. Or maybe just around this edge of the board, yeah. Take your pick. Okay. The other thing I should mention about unified theories is that there's also a very nice signature of unified theories. Once you put in quarks and leptons into the same representation, the gauge interactions, which just couples the different components, will couple together quarks and leptons. And so you can have processes which convert quarks into leptons and vice versa. And so this will lead to a very distinctive signature, which is proton decay. So we haven't seen proton decay experimentally, but it's the smoking gun signature of grand unification. The limits on proton decay are very, very long, but that just tells you that the mass scale associated with unification has to be very, very high. So it's not inconsistent, but we haven't found it yet. Okay.
Considering the expected length, when you approximate the proton, you don't really approximate it. You are some years ahead, but then how, what is the expected length scale of these?
Yeah, the expected energy scale is around 10 to the 16 GeV. So, you can also make it consistent roughly with neutrino masses. So you can have neutrino, the mass of the Majorana mass of the right-handed neutrino can also be roughly around that scale. So you could have unification and the seesaw mechanism occurring through a roughly similar scale. So that's kind of nice. Okay. Next, I wanted to talk about dark matter. But it's just easier if I just show you slides. So I just have some slides to show. And again, I've had to pick and choose different topics, so there's many more things I can discuss, which you'll hear about, I'm sure, in the Beyond the Standard Model course. But I just have to give you a sample of different things. And since I work on dark matter, of course, I have to discuss it. All right, so we'll just talk about dark matter. So the dark matter puzzle is basically, there are two ways to measure mass in the universe. One is by just looking, seeing the light of stars and gas, and just adding up the total mass of that stuff. That's the luminous mass. There's another way to measure mass is to infer mass based on gravity. So you look at the way things are moving. That tells you about the gravity of the thing that it's moving around. And so you can infer, based on dynamics, the mass of an object as well. And so the dark matter puzzle is that those two things don't agree with one another. Fritz Zwicky, a Swiss physicist, was the first person to propose dark matter, and he coined the term dark matter. Of course, he said it in German, back in the 30s, but he wasn't taken very seriously. Part of the reason why is he's actually just a jerk of a guy. So if you didn't agree with Zwicky, then Zwicky would just call you a bastard. And if you really didn't agree with him, he would call you the worst kind of bastard, which is a spherical bastard. So you were a bastard any way he looked at you. So for several decades, this idea kind of languished. But it became much, much more convincing in the 70s due to work by Vera Rubin and her colleagues. Let's just go through the historical arguments for dark matter. Here is Zwicky's argument. Can we dim the lights a little bit more? No? Let's see. Nope. Okay, almost. Oh, yeah, that would be good. Okay, great. Thank you very much. So here's Zwicky's argument. Oh. I don't know what happened.
Just talk really loud.
Oh, can we go back to the presentation, please?
Turned off, but the projector has to cool for a few seconds before it starts again.
Okay, thank you.
So I've started it. It might take a few seconds.
Okay. So I'll just keep talking, and then you'll see the pictures when they come up. What Zwicky was looking at is an object called the Coma Cluster. The Coma Cluster is a collection of galaxies, around, let's say, 1,000 galaxies. And the idea is they're all bound together based on their mutual gravitational attraction. And so you can just add up, based on how fast they're moving around, is there enough mass in the Coma Cluster for them to actually be gravitationally bound? Or are they moving too fast to be gravitationally bound? So what he found is that there's actually not enough mass. You just add up the mass of all those galaxies. There's not enough mass. They're moving too fast. They should just all fly apart from one another. So Zwicky said there must be some mass that could not be seen to hold them together. Now, actually, there was a source of mass that Zwicky didn't know about, which came in the form of gas. Going to happen. Okay. Okay, cool. All right, let's just turn it up. Let's see. Okay, this might work. Okay, all right, so I think this might work. Yeah, okay. Great, thanks. Okay, so here's the argument. Clusters are moving too fast. There must be some extra mass to increase the depth of the gravitational potential well to keep them all bound together. There is an extra form of matter in the form of gas, which Zwicky couldn't see at the time, but we can see now because it emits X-rays. So we can see how much gas there is in addition to the mass of the actual galaxies. But when you add up the mass of the stars and the gas, you only get 15% of what you need. So that's only 15% of the total mass. And so 85% you still need to include in the form of dark matter. Here's Vera Rubin's argument, and it's based on much smaller objects, galaxies. She just looked at how fast stars are moving around in a spiral galaxy. So here's a star. It's moving on a circle like this. And you can use Newton's law and the law of centripetal motion to tell you a relationship between the velocity and the gravitational force. The gravitational force just depends on the mass enclosed within this orbit. And so by measuring the velocity as a function of radius, you're measuring how much mass there is enclosed as a function of radius. So So here's the idea. What you get with and without dark matter In the center of the galaxy, the stars are moving around at a very similar speed to both cases, but in the outskirts of the galaxies, the stars are moving much slower without dark matter compared to what you have with dark matter. So it tells you that in the outer part of galaxies, you're actually dominated by dark matter. Here is the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest neighbor, and a plot shows you velocity as a function of distance from the center of the galaxy. Now what you see is the rotational velocity is flat as you go out to very, very large distances, even though you can tell by eye that the luminous matter is concentrated in the center. So even when there is no luminous matter at all, the rotation curve is flat. Now, using Newton's law, constant velocity means that the mass, derivative of the mass with respect to radius is constant. That means that every slice in radius has an equal mass, as long as the velocity is constant. And so there is the same mass here, as there is out here. It tells you that dark matter is spread out very much farther than the distribution of regular matter. You can also see dark matter through gravitational lensing. The idea is that you have a lens, which is just a massive cluster, and it bends the path of light from a distant source. So here the source is this blue galaxy here, and by passing around this massive cluster, the gravitational lens, the apparent position is different than the true position. Now, you can actually do this, and people have. So here is an image of a gravitational lens. The cluster is all of the yellow galaxies here, and the distant source is this blue galaxy, which you can see spread out kind of in like a ring around this object. Now you can invert the problem and say, what is the dark matter distribution that I would need to give you this lensing image? So here's what they get. So this is a plot of mass as a function of the two-dimensional projection on the sky. So you're looking at the sky, and this is the amount of mass that you would see through that line of sight. So the first thing you'll notice are all of the spikes. Those are the individual galaxies in the cluster. But behind that, you notice this very broad feature, which is the dark matter. It's much, much more massive than the individual galaxies, and it's spread out much, much more diffusely than the galaxies are. So here is the picture. Galaxies are just tiny objects inside of a much, much bigger dark matter halo. So the structure of visible matter is really determined by the dark matter. It dominates over the visible matter. Another interesting thing is that disk galaxies, especially thin disk galaxies, are actually just unstable without the dark matter there. The galaxy is unstable to small perturbations, and so it would start to wiggle around and just fall apart and flop into a big mess without the dark matter to stabilize it. So the fact that we see spiral galaxies in the universe tells us that there must be these dark matter halos. One question you might have is, could dark matter be made from baryons? Could it just be made like faint stars or planets or gas that we just can't see? The answer is no, and we know this by studying the abundances of light isotopes, which are created in the very early universe, around the time of a minute after the Big Bang, before stars had even formed. So what it tells us is that the one in particular that's the most constraining is the abundance of deuterium in the universe. Here is the fraction of deuterium versus the density of baryons, and it follows the curve along this orange line here. So what we observe for the fraction of deuterium is around this, tells us the baryon density is this. What you would need to explain all of the dark matter is you would need a baryon density, which is larger by around a factor of 6, and so it would predict way too little deuterium in the universe than what we see. So we actually would see less deuterium than what we observe. So we know that baryons do not comprise dark matter. So it must be some new particle beyond the Standard Model, a new field that we have to introduce into the Lagrangian. Here is a timeline of the universe. I just want to make the point that right now, we know dark matter comprises only a quarter of the energy density of the universe. Most of it is made out of dark energy. But earlier in the universe, throughout most of the universe's history, it was dominated by dark matter. From a time around 100,000 years after the Big Bang up to around 10 billion years, dark matter was the dominant form of mass energy in the universe. So what the universe looks like is determined by dark matter. The structure of the universe is determined by dark matter. So what we can do is ask, how does dark matter form structure in the universe? And the nice thing is that we can see a snapshot of the early universe in the form of the cosmic microwave background. This tells us what the fluctuations were in the density of matter at a very, very early time, around 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe was in its infancy. So what you're seeing here are patterns of hot and cold spots on the sky, and those match onto where dark matter is densest or less dense, because where there's a clump of dark matter, the plasma of electrons and protons will fall into that clump and get hot. So you can start with that initial condition and ask what happens to dark matter. That's done by computer simulations. Basically, you put dark matter in a box and ask what happens under gravity. So around 200 million years after the Big Bang, here's what it looks like. It's fairly diffuse, but as we evolve in time, you can see that dark matter gets clumpier and clumpier. So now we can take a ride through the dark matter universe. Imagine you could go into a spaceship and fly through the dark matter universe. This is what you would see. You see each of these little clumps of dark matter would be a dark matter halo. And you can see that they're organized in a very interesting way. This is the so-called cosmic web. They're not spread out evenly throughout the universe, but you have filaments where you have these streaks of dark matter clumps, and you have these huge nodes where the filaments come together, which are very, very massive clumps of dark matter. So this dark matter structure should tell us what the visible matter should look like, because visible matter is attracted to the dark matter. It follows the mass of dark matter. So here are the predictions. When we look at the dark matter universe, we have these tiny dark matter clumps, we have dark matter in filaments, and we have these giant dark matter nodes. And then we also have voids where there's very little dark matter. And then in terms of the visible universe, these tiny clumps are the dark matter halos. And so this is like Vera Rubin's observations. She discovered these dark matter halos. But we should see galaxies organized along filaments. We should see clusters of galaxies where there are huge clumps of visible matter in many, many galaxies. And then we should see voids where there are very few galaxies. So let's get back into the spaceship and go through the real universe. Here we go. So now we're flying through the real universe. And what you're seeing are real galaxies. This is from a survey called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Each galaxy is a real galaxy at its actual position in the universe. And we're flying through about a billion light years. And what you want to look at is, how are the galaxies organized? Can you see that they're organized into filaments? And can you see these huge nodes where there are many, many galaxies all clumped together? And can you see that there are sometimes voids where there are very few galaxies located in? So what's the verdict? Does it seem to follow the predictions from dark matter? Can you kind of see it with your eye? Yes? No? Yes, okay. The other thing I should mention is this is 1% of 1% of 1% of the observable universe. So there's actually, I think, 500,000 galaxies in this fly-through, but the real observable universe is a million times larger than that. So it just puts you in perspective a little bit, I guess. So dark matter, let me just go 2 more minutes. Dark matter is a particle physics problem because we want to include a particle which could be dark matter. Everything that we know about dark matter comes from its gravitational influence in the universe, but to discover its actual properties, its Lagrangian, its interaction, its symmetries, what forces does it participate in, we need to know its non-gravitational interactions. And so there's many ways to do this, and I'll just highlight a couple of ways. One is to look for them at the LHC. So here is the beam line of the LHC, this dotted line, and here's a collision of two protons. So it produces a lot of hadronic junk, a lot of hadrons in the final state. But then what you get are potentially states which go transverse to the direction of the beam. So this event is actually where we produce two Z bosons. One of them is going into two muons, which is like this, and the other is going into two electrons, which looks like this. Okay? So the transverse momentum has to balance out. So the momentum of this pair should balance out the momentum of those pair. Now you can imagine if dark matter interacted through the Z boson, the Z could go to dark matter on one side. So what you would see is a Z going to two muons on one side, and then nothing on the other side. you would have a momentum imbalance. And so that momentum imbalance tells you that there's something missing on the other side. So OK, yeah, dark matter might be a heavy neutrino, and it could be produced through the weak force. The other idea is called direct detection. Let me skip this for now. And another idea is you can have dark matter with forces that are purely for dark matter particles. These are called dark forces. So here's the Feynman diagram. We have some new force that's only for dark matter particles. Dark matter is interacting with itself. How do we probe this? Well, it changes the shape of halos. If you have no forces, the halo is very dense in the center. And if you do have forces, it causes it to be less dense in the center, just because particles from outside kick the particles from the inside out to larger distances. So it changes the shape of these halos. And again, we can go back to rotation curves to see if we can detect the imprint of those halos on the data. So here is data for a rotation curve of one particular galaxy. And if you have a core in the galaxy, which is less dense, you produce the blue line. And if you have a very dense region from collisionless dark matter, you would have the red line. And so the data seems to prefer this idea where perhaps dark matter is interacting in the centers of galaxies. But that's just one possible explanation among many. So that's all. So the conclusion is that dark matter is a particle physics problem. But right now, we don't know how to include it in the standard model. But we want to figure out ways to detect its properties. OK, so that's all.